everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Brexit Podcast. I'm your host, Jennifer Han, and the biggest Brexit news of the last couple of days is that the repeal bill was finally published on the 13th of July. Now, if that doesn't mean much to you, don't worry, because for today's look behind what the news actually means, my co-host Tim Humming chatted to the director of think tank Open Europe and recurring guest Henry Newman to give us all a bit of a refresher on what the bill is, why it matters, and why Theresa May's minority government will probably struggle to get it through Parliament. If you enjoy this episode and you want to hear more Brexit news and opinions like this, please do subscribe to us wherever you're listening to this podcast, or find us on the usual social platforms at Brexit Podcast and at BrexitPodcast.com.
Tim Farron, the outgoing Liberal leader, said invoking the Great Repeal Bill will be how. He's a man of theology. Maybe we should sit up and take some notice. Theresa May says it's an essential step. So, in a nutshell, what is the repeal bill and why is it so important?
Well, the repeal bill is rather badly named. It's no longer called the Great Repeal Bill, but it's nonetheless slightly misleading title, because what it's actually doing is trying to seek to keep the law pretty much the same when we leave the European Union. So the best way to imagine it is to envisage a trap door through which European Union law will fall into the sort of domestic sphere. So it'll try to move the sphere of European Union law, which is Britain's been subject to since we became a member, into the domestic sphere. So the point of the bill is actually to keep things the same rather than to change things at the point when we leave.
Okay, can you give us... So this show goes out on Tuesday, but it was published last Thursday. So can you give us a bit of a rundown of some of the most important bits?
Of the bill overall?
Yes, please.
So what the bill will do is it'll repeal the 1972 European Communities Act, which is the bill that gave European law supremacy in the UK over domestic law. And that's the sort of the totemic act which makes us subject to the European Court of Justice and subject to the directives and other regulations coming out of Europe. So by repealing that, it will sort of break the link between Brussels and the Luxembourg Court and the UK, and it'll set us off on the path to membership. But actually, what it will try to do is keep broadly the law exactly the same. So it won't deal with what some Eurosceptics would like to see, which is a sort of a restriction of regulation coming from Europe to get rid of, say, the Habitats Directive or another directive that they don't like, the Working Time Directive. It won't do any of that. It'll keep things broadly the same. But nonetheless, it's an enormously complicated piece of legislation. The original 1972 Act was a sort of landmark constitutional act which changed the legal landscape in this country by introducing a new sphere of law, European Union law. And this is essentially trying to do the reverse. So it's one of the most complicated acts in some respects, but it's actually, in of itself, the bill is not enormous.
I see. So who's going to decide now what legislation that we keep or what has to be amended? So who does it fall to? I know David Davis was saying that a lot of it was formality, but then the critics were saying that perhaps there was a bit more to it than that.
So the purpose is actually that... The sort of ideal compromise would be that nothing does change, that the bill essentially changes everything to keep everything exactly the same. But part of the problem with this is that much of the European Union law that's currently, which we're currently subject to in the UK, refers to European institutions such as the Commission. And obviously, we can't simply transpose those into domestic law, because once we're outside of the European Union, it wouldn't make sense for us to follow the Commission. So those bits will have to be amended. And therefore, around the side of this bill will be needed between 800 and 1,000 pieces of secondary legislation to deal with those sort of tying up the loose odds and ends. And that's going to be an area of enormous political focus over the coming 2 years. So the bill itself will be politically difficult to pass, but in addition to that, there'll be between 800 and 1,000 additional pieces of legislation over which we can expect very significant parliamentary battles.
So this is where the sort of controversy and the conflict lies. The Scottish and Welsh government is not particularly happy with the current situation. And why is that?
So from the Scottish and Welsh point of view, they are arguing that they would like to see powers that are coming back from Europe as a result of Brexit being devolved down to their level. Somewhat inevitably, they're keen that those decisions are made in Cardiff and Edinburgh rather than in Westminster. And they are accusing Downing Street of effecting a power grab through this bill, and they're seeking to deny consent for this legislation to pass. And one of the conventions, although it's not a rule, is that Westminster won't legislate on matters that affect the devolved administrations unless they have a consent motion passed in the devolved assemblies. And at this point, the Welsh and the Scottish are refusing to pass such a consent motion. So that could be one area of conflict. But there are certainly other areas as well. So my view, though, is at a macro level that this bill will ultimately pass. The question is just how amended will it be? It will pass because nobody on the Labour side will want to be seen to have blocked Brexit, and voting against this bill at third reading would be tantamount to blocking Brexit, because Brexit simply cannot proceed if we don't repeal the 1972 European Communities Act. So I don't think that anybody will, I don't think the opposition as a whole, there may be individual rebels, but the opposition as a whole won't want to be on the wrong side of that argument. But they certainly will want to seek to make as many amendments as possible and to make the government's position very, very difficult.
And what about pro-Remain Tory MPs and the DUP? And we're in a hung parliament situation, so it may not just be rebels from the Labour side that could have an influence.
Absolutely. So I think there's a lot of concern around the secondary legislation that I referred to, these 800 to 1,000 statutory instruments, which are going to be needed to do what I was saying was tying up the odds and ends, and there'll be a lot of attention to those, and how much scrutiny they should be afforded, and the extent of the powers which the government will have to use. Henry VIII powers are really executive writ rather than to work through Parliament. So that'll be very controversial. And it's likely that some of the more Remain-minded Conservatives will also focus in on that as well. So critics would argue it's ironic that they're very concerned now about the passage of these statutory instruments, because as a European Union member, we're obliged to pass huge amounts of statutory instruments to bring European law onto the statute books. But nonetheless, that's one area of likely opposition. The Labour Party have also argued that they would like to see the European Charter of Fundamental Rights incorporated into domestic law. And this, again, is an area of a particular controversy. I suspect, though, that this is actually one space where they will be defeated by the government, because even those Conservatives who are more on the soft Remain side and have been very strong defenders of, say, the European Convention of Human Rights, like Dominic Grieve, have been very critical about the European Charter. So I think that's one area where Labour's opposition actually will be less effective than it could otherwise be.
Yes, because you said there that the European Charter of Fundamental Rights is not incorporated. I mean, some of the others are, obviously. The European Charter of Fundamental Rights, from a top line, sounds like a good thing. So why wouldn't we want to incorporate it?
Well, I think there's obviously widespread concerns that it would give judges too much power. It would be bad. But also, more specifically, the UK was promised at the time when the charter was being first mooted in Brussels that it wouldn't have a legal effect on the UK. I think if I'm correct in saying that Keith Vaz was Europe Minister at the time and said it would have no more legal effect than the Beano. And Tony Blair made similar remarks that it wasn't going to affect things. And then we were told it would only apply when within the scope of European Union law. And certainly this will be sort of one area of particular controversy, that by bringing this charter into domestic law, by incorporating it, that we would create all kinds of new statutory duties against which government and public authorities could be tested in judicial review.
Sure. Does it have a crossover to the settled status that Theresa May was proposed a couple of weeks ago?
Potentially, yes. But I think that's a sort of almost a broad argument about the role of the European Court after we leave, after we are no longer a member. And I think one of the biggest sticking points so far on the settled status of European Union nationals has been that the request by Brussels, or the demand by Brussels, that the European Court continues to have jurisdiction over EU nationals living in the UK once Britain has left the European Union. And that's been broadly rejected by by the government. I think what we're likely to see there is some sort of compromise position, perhaps a hybrid court of consisting of both European Union judges and British Supreme Court judges or British senior judges meeting together to determine these things. That could be one model that gets. I think we'll find a compromise solution on that.
Yeah. What you talked earlier there about the massive secondary legislation that needs to go through. But there's some things that it is, you know, the minister's prevented from using that legislation to amend or repeal the Human Rights Act of 98 or repeal the Northern Ireland Act of 98. So, or increase taxes, in fact. So those, I suppose, are considered that important that they need to stand outside of that kind of executive power.
Right, so it's interesting that the government has sort of offered those concessions proactively. I think as an example of trying to demonstrate that they're not seeking enormous powers of ministerial diktat. But I suspect there'll be, as I said, further pressure around that and further demands for scrutiny over these Henry VIII powers. So that's I think will be one area where there'll be a lot of focus. But the main point really is that. Only a few weeks ago, people were writing how this was a sort of dead session parliament and the Queen's speech was extraordinarily thin. I think the opposite is true. This is going to be a huge parliamentary battle over these amendments and over the secondary legislation. In a hung parliament, power inevitably transfers from 10 Downing Street towards the cabinet, but then also from the cabinet to parliament. And parliament is going to be the seat and the focus of all these discussions and debates. And the repeal bill, as a constitutional bill, will likely be debated in its committee stages on the floor of the House. So there'll be an enormous amount of parliamentary theatre around this. And we should expect, as we've heard, sort of strong opposition from the minority parties as well as from Labour and different factions within Labour and different factions within the Conservatives. So this will be an exciting parliamentary session in lots of senses.
Is that why they need a month and a half off before they reconvene? The timing seems somewhat strange. They go into recess in a few days' time, and then the House doesn't return until September the 5th. I mean, we're on a really short time schedule since Article 50 was called anyway.
I think that there's always a summer recess. I wouldn't sort of look into conspiracy for that, but I think there's I'm sure there'll be more than enough time to debate the repeal bill at great length in Parliament. So, I mean, I'm not particularly worried about that.
Okay, and then just finally, there were a few more Brexit-related opposition papers published. I noticed in the Open Europe, the great daily roundup that you do, which covered the nuclear material, safeguarding issues, ongoing judicial and ministerial proceedings, and privileges and immunities. Is there anything there that we should be wary of?
Well, I think the ongoing sort of dispute over Euratom is certainly one to watch, and we've heard a lot about this in recent days, but it wasn't a particularly significant feature of the referendum campaign. And Euratom is a separate institution to the European Union, but as a result of various changes, not least the Lisbon Treaty in 2007, the two institutions have become very intertwined. And the government made an argument, which I think was rather weakly presented, that it was necessary to leave Euratom to protect Theresa May's red line about the control of the European Court after Brexit. In fact, I think the government could have made a much better case that actually it would be very difficult to remain a member of Euratom outside of the EU, given the intertwining of the institutions. But nonetheless, this has been an area of significant parliamentary attention over the last few days. And we've had Labour and Conservative MPs campaigning very strongly and making the case that we should stay in Euratom. Now, whether or not that's legally possible, it's certainly the case that if we leave Euratom without transitional arrangements, that could have quite complicated and negative effects on our on nuclear medicine in the UK, on nuclear research, but also on our civil nuclear energy program. So the government will need to be doing a lot of explaining over the next few weeks and a lot of listening to critics and actually and also some reassuring of people who've, I think, been very worried by newspaper headlines over the last few days that radioactive medicine could be put at risk if we leave. So this is one of the areas where I think the government needs to be doing more work and more listening.
Do you have a personal view on whether we should stay in or be out of Euratom?
I mean, my personal view is it may be very difficult to stay in, but I would actually be very relaxed about the European Court having jurisdiction in the UK over nuclear scientists. I think it's relatively unlikely that the European Court often overreaches itself, but free movement of nuclear scientists is something that I, as a Leaver, could happily put up with. And if the European Court suddenly chose to redefine Polish plumbers and Hungarian businessmen and women as nuclear scientists to essentially create a back door for free movement, then we could look to leave Euratom later on. So personally, I think if a way can be found for us to stay in, I'm relatively relaxed about that. I don't think we should be too religiously dogmatic about these red lines.
Okay, great, thanks. And just on Open Europe itself, Henry, have you got any exciting plans coming up in the future?
Yes, one of the things that we're going to be looking carefully at is the broader question of immigration. And obviously this was a key question during the referendum debate. And a lot of people have interpreted the referendum results as a vote against immigration. And our premise is that it's not that simple, that people want to have the confidence that government has control over our immigration system. They want to feel that people who come to Britain to work or to study are coming here to work or to study and not to to enjoy our generous benefit system or our good public services, but they want to have the confidence that people are paying in and contributing to society. And so we're going to be looking at some of the attitudes of the public towards immigration and trying to help the government design a better immigration policy that can meet some of these public concerns, but equally not pull up the drawbridge.
Yeah, government needs to win hearts and minds on immigration as much as anything else.
Absolutely, and I think some of the, unfortunately, the government's sort of stubborn refusal to guarantee the rights of EU nationals who'd come to Britain legitimately over the past decades, and the refusal of the government to guarantee their rights, their right to remain, created an enormous amount of bad will. And whether or not it was the intention, people have felt that they have been used as political pawns in a negotiation, and that's hugely regrettable. So I think government needs to sort of work carefully on this, and actually, of course, they need to address the public concern about migration, but equally that they need to listen to the concerns of business as well, and recognise the contribution that immigrants make.
Okay. Henry, thanks ever so much for joining us again on the Brexit podcast.
Thank you. Cheers.
As always, thanks for listening. And if you enjoy the show, please feel free to subscribe to us and follow us on the usual social networks at Brexit Podcast and at brexitpodcast.com to stay up to date on all the best Brexit news and opinions. The show is produced by Jennifer Han, Tim Hemming and Warren Paul, and our theme song is courtesy of Kevin MacLeod.